Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Preeta, and I will be your host for our weekly Awaken Global Awaken Call. Today, our special guest speaker is the remarkable Robert Yazzie, who's someone who has really invented, in some ways, today's theme of the Navajo notion of justice, or actually brought it to light. Our guest this week has revived Navajo peacemaking practices with a focus on healing and solidarity within a community. He emphasizes healing and solidarity more than on punishment of offenders and on consensus building rather than on assignment of fault. The question for our reflection is that whenever you have been involved in informal or formal dispute resolution, what practices have contributed most to your sense of justice? Since we have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Sujatha Baliga, today, I thought we could start by asking her to kick off our circle.
Great to be here.
So if you'd like to introduce Justice Yazzie, we can move into conversation.
Sure. So I had the incredible honor of meeting the Honorable Justice Robert Yazzie many years ago at this point at a National Restorative Justice Conference. Justice Yazzie spoke beautifully about sort of the relationship of restorative justice, which tends to be the secularized Western notion in the way we think about it in sort of the American and Western context. And his understanding of these words from the Diné worldview, the Navajo worldview, and it was one of the most life-changing experiences that I'd had. I was sad to say I'd sort of known of him when I lived in New Mexico years earlier, but because he's such an international rock star, I was too shy to go to the Navajo Nation to reach out to him, to try to connect with him. It's a big regret on my part that I hadn't done it sooner, because he was the most approachable person that I had ever met, and so humble and so willing to say, yes, come and learn. And I hesitate to say that because I worry that every person on this call will then call him and say, can I come learn from you? And he'll say yes to everyone. But I think what is amazing to me is his prodigious heart and mind, and his capacity to think about both sort of his own spiritual tradition, his own people's way, and Western law. And so I could list out his entire resume for you, and how he went to Oberlin College long before there were other people leaving the Navajo Nation to go do that. And he went on to law school and studied both Western law, and then his thinking today around the nexus of learning Navajo legal thinking as well as Western legal thinking, and his dedication to teaching young Navajo lawyers how to manage both of those worlds, necessity today. But more than that, I think I would want to say that Justice Yazzie is somebody who not only walks the talk in his own way of being in the world, but also grapples with what is the right thing to do, both personally and collectively, in the face of colonialism, in the without negativity, with this constant, one of the greatest phrases that I've heard from him is, how are we going to move forward in a good way? And so for me, my connection to him is about that, is about how do we move forward in a good way, is the teaching that I repeatedly return to from my relationship with Justice Yazzie. So with that, Justice Yazzie, I'm just going to ask you some questions, if that's the next step, Preeta.
Yes, it is. Thank you for that beautiful introduction.
Great. So, Justice Yazzie, I'd love to start with just some more basic questions about sort of, I know it's kind of big, but maybe a little bit about, if you could start with a little bit about the Diné worldview. And I you know, we'll get to maybe questions of what does justice look like, et cetera. But I think maybe many people on the call are not necessarily well versed in the wisdom of your people, and so I think it's helpful to start maybe with a little bit of what it is that when you think about the law, eventually how you start with worldview.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sujatha. It was good to hear from you again, and I'm very happy to be here to share my knowledge and experience. And so the question about what is the worldview of the Navajo people as to the notion of Navajo justice. And what I can recall at this moment is what the holy people, in our understanding of the holy ones, are the ones who we say, so the Zendo sent means that with their prayers and songs is what made it possible for them to put into place the earth and the universe. And the holy people, with their songs and prayers, they managed to put the what we call in Navajo, in Sahak case, thinking, as they place the earth and the universe in place. And thereafter, they saw fit to put into place what the mind can do or what the mind should do. So what the holy people did is they put the planning into the mountains, into the water. And then after that, they saw fit to put the life into the wind, and then the lastly was to look at the end result of their creation, which is the word Sahasin. It's very difficult to explain that even in Navajo, but at best that word Sahasin adds to the end result. Or the resilience. After you have done challenge a task, your end result should be able to come up with some workable solution, some practical solution. So as we look at this, what the holy people did, we don't really talk about the circle as a lot of people do, but what we do talk about is without mentioning the circle, we talk about the cycle of what we experience every day. The minute we get up, we see the sunlight. Even before the sun comes up, our people would go and stand toward the east with their corn pollen. And Sichahuranahasle means may the world be good to me. And so as they pray to the east, it's the beginning of the day. And then as time goes, whatever you prayed for should come to pass. Whatever you prayed for should be your agenda for the day. And as such, when you, at the end of the day, you begin to reflect on what you have thought about, and what you have accomplished, and where you're at, and whether you are successful or not. So basically, that's the short summary of what the worldview is about. So, and that idea of the circle, it goes hand in hand with the mountains that we have and the waters. As far as the mountain, we have names for some of the main mountains that contribute to our way of thinking, to our way of doing things, the way we live, and the way we try to keep in mind as to what is important for the day, and how do we resolve certain issues. And so when we look at the worldview, one of the most basic things to our way of thinking is, I guess, when we talk about values and principles, it's very difficult to explain that into English, and because the English philosophy and the Navajo philosophy are sometimes they're just opposite. There's a big difference, but it's not impossible to explain the Navajo philosophy to an English audience. So here, what I have to say is, when we look at good, we look at the word huzon, and I think the word huzon is what gives a foundation to what a lot of people in America understand to be, which is the restorative justice. So to us, restorative justice is something that started right from the time of creation. The concept of restorative justice started with the creation of the earth, the universe, the moon, the sun, the water, the air, everything that we see, everything that gives us sustainability. At the same time, that concept of huzon, the good, is always the opposite. I have a gentleman whom I respect a lot. His name is Tom Sowell. I call him my grandfather. He told me one time, whenever we think about philosophy, we think of a pair in life. What he meant was there's an element of good, and at the same time, there is an element what we call just the opposite, the bad, which we call huzon. So when we look at those two elements, we use in the stories and the songs and the prayers in order to achieve healing. We relate to the word huzon, which is used a lot in the ceremonies, in the songs and prayers. When somebody, when we live our life daily, when we walk within the circle, and we must walk clockwise, as we do, we always think of that one word that is an aspiration constantly, which is the word good, huzon, good, huzon. Even at the end of saying our prayers, we say, then the elders would say, that is what you need to say to sustain yourself. And that is basic to our worldview. So as I said, when somebody gets sick, everybody wants to live a good life all the time. But there comes a time when there's a force of disruption that interferes with your state of goodness or state of huzon in a way that disruption causes a disharmony to your huzon way of life. So the medicine people would say if you begin to experience a life of disharmony, then the best thing to do is to act on it, think about it. And when you do, you'll find someone who has the ability to diagnose the problem, to diagnose what is causing the disruption in your life and why are you living with a sad state of mind and disharmony.
So Justice Yazzie, sorry to interrupt. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit. So who it is that it is that when you say that there's that someone to intervene at that point to help diagnose it, can you tell me a little bit more, tell us a little bit more about sort of who that person is and how that person operates in relationship to the person who's experiencing that disruption in the force of goodness? Justice Yazzie? Sorry, folks, I think we might be having a technical difficulty. We'll sort it out in just one moment.
Justice Yazzie?
Yes. I'm here.
Justice Yazzie, did you hear my question?
Yes, I did.
Okay, great. So I was asking you to tell us a bit about sort of who is that person who can diagnose or be a part of sort of helping people understand sort of the force of of disruption. Thank you.
Well, let me just give my own personal experience.
Wonderful. Thank you.
When I I'm a very busy person, and I like it that way. So I'm most happy when I aim at accomplishing a lot for the benefit of the people. And there are times unknowingly I would come upon something that would cause me to feel ill, and so to the point that I need to see somebody. And in Navajo, we would say there are people who are trained to diagnose your sickness, your illness, and they can do it with a smoke. They can do gaze at the star, or they can see things in the fireplace. And they would say that they would ask you some question about the whatever problem you may be having for some detail. And once they have done asking questions, and they would, look to see what's causing the problem. And then after a while, they would pause and think about it, and then tell you that whatever you're experiencing is from this particular forces. And this is where the person who's diagnosing the problem has managed to identify the cause of the disharmony. And so sometimes it could be mental, sometimes it could be spiritual, or sometimes your body is experiencing aches and pains. And I've gone through those types of experience. So after that, I feel relieved that at least I know, the cause of my problem. And then the person who, the medicine person, man or woman, would say, well, I have some options. The way in which that the cause of your illness can be neutralized or eliminated. So once he or she tells me that, they would say, they would give me a recommendation that I should have an overnight ceremony. And before that, what they would recommend is before you get a good way ceremony or a beauty way ceremony, the best thing to do is to take care of that whatever problem is causing a disruption to your life. And sometimes with a prayer, the person would do a perform what we call hayakye, means whatever was put into your mind and your body needs to be taken out. And after that, then you're ready for an all-night ceremony. So once you go through that process, then at some point you would begin to feel better. And this is where you can say, I usually say, means I've been restored back to harmony. And sometimes, when I reach that state of restoration, I'm reminded to that it's very important that I have to take care of myself, and that I must work at maintaining my sense of sahasen, my sense of resilience. And so
Justice Yazzie, when I think about this, what always comes up for me as you're describing these ceremonies and these experiences is that there's not this bright line that I see drawn between different types of good. There's a way in which I think in the Western world, we can think of, you know, there's like wellness in terms of medicine, and then, you know, satisfaction in terms of an outcome in a courtroom. And what I find interesting in what in the way in which I think you think of things is that cogent is something that is something we're moving towards in all aspects of our lives. I'd love to know, but for some of us, I think when our minds stay separated, right, that somehow there's a medical area and a legal area and a sort of in the way in which we draw these categories. How is it that you draw these principles and these ideas that I hear you speaking about in an all-night ceremony, for example, into a courtroom on the Navajo Nation?
Okay. Right now, we're working toward changing the American model of jury system. As Navajo people, we have probably 11 courts located throughout our land base, which covers 27,000 square acres, and we have 11 court systems located throughout our nation. And so managed to use the American model of court system to address the social problems that we have. Social problems meaning that we have a number of cases pending with our court system involving domestic violence, involving alcohol abuse, drug abuse, involving sexual abuse, child neglect, abandonment, and suicide, and those are just some of the examples. We're having a difficult time trying to operate our court system, and sometimes it takes a lot of resources, a lot of money, and it's something that we come short of. We don't have all the money. So when people ask for a jury trial, normally, since we don't have the resources, the people are told, yes, you do have a right to a jury trial, but you have to pay for the jury trial. So a jury trial in a civil or criminal civil case or criminal case, it costs, what one lawyer said, maybe as much as $17,000, you know, a case. Mm. So now we have a problem with our jury system. People who have been charged with serious crimes request for jury trial, but end up not getting the benefit of a jury trial. So what we have said now is that we should, since we don't have the means to pay for it, we have to resort to our own Navajo legal mind. What is it that we can do? And I think this is where we look at the circle for solutions. We look at the past, the stories that have been told to us by our ancestors. And if you get into a bind, there are certain things that can be done to overcome those problems. So what we have done is that in the Navajo court system, a person is entitled to a jury of no less than 6 jury panel. So, and the thought is to put the net way into the jury system. By that I mean that instead of having the jury system that usually functions like a regular jury in the state or federal court, where the juries are told about that if you have the ability to listen to the evidence and be able to come up with a decision, then you're qualified. So So our thought is we don't need to have a regular jury system that is drawn from the American model. We can rework that model to fit our own value system. So by that I mean that instead of having the jurors be called the jurors, we call them Natani's. Natani means leadership, being leaders. So if we have the ability to redo the jury system with leaders to preside over the a jury session, that's a traditional way, we could allow for relatives to come in if the offenders chooses to participate in this, the net jury system, then he must waive his right to remain silent. But anything that he says in this, the net jury system, would be protected. Anything that he says will not be used against him in time to come. So you asked me the question, how does that, you know, the ceremonial way work into that the jury model? Well, I think the way in which we're thinking about how our value system, how our traditional principles, our customs and our tradition can really help fix things up. And in a regular jury system, like we always say, I mean, people always talk about in an American system, you're always looking for fault and blaming somebody for the wrong done. So, but in the net jury system, we don't look for that. What we do is the aim is to look at the whole situation holistically, meaning that if you have a person who is charged with battery or you could say with violence in the domestic violence situation, that person would come before the six sitting Natanis and be able to participate in the process along with the victim if that is possible. So what is unique about this arrangement is to allow the victim to come with his or her relatives for support. And likewise, with the offenders would do the same thing, would come in to the circle with his or her relatives. So in this way, the people are encouraged by the court to talk things out and also to allow the six sitting Natanis to help the parties to define the problem. If the person who was charged for, like say, assault and battery, and the prosecutor has pending charges, but now the offender says, I don't want to go through the regular American model type system. I want to go through the DNS system. So when that happens, the leaders would help to get to the bottom of the problem. As a judge, I used to always stick to the box, meaning that if a person is charged with a crime, I would follow the procedures of the court to the letter, and then achieve justice in that respect. But after a while, I just began to question my role as a judge, and then using the American law, is that really doing something good to the people?
Can you tell me, Justice Yazzie, can you tell me a little bit about what it was that caused you to start to question it? So for you, what was that experience like when you were sort of following the letter of the law, and how did you make this sort of transition?
When I graduated from law school, University of New Mexico School of Law. When I graduated, I used to always think that lawyers and judges is an answer to everything, to all the problems that we have. But after I was appointed, I took the job as a judge in the Window Rock District Court in Arizona, and within the Navajo Nation. And then I began to analyze all the cases that come before me. I have had all kinds of cases because our court is a court of general jurisdiction, even though we have a model that we follow, that of the state and federal courts. We have our own process. I mean, we allow the people to speak the Navajo language rather than English. But when English-speaking attorneys come in, they are entitled to have a Navajo interpreter. But anyway, one day, as I started with a criminal case, and when the witnesses were being called, an elderly man raised his hand in the audience. And right away, I told him that, you know, you are interrupting with our judicial proceeding in Navajo. I said, if you do that one more time, I have no choice but I will hold you in contempt of court. So what I said bothered me for days. And I didn't feel good, you know, having to tell an elderly man the consequence of his action. So, and to this day, I clearly understand what was wrong with what I gave him. And then I said to myself, if I had given the opportunity to listen to his wisdom, he would have, you know, some options that are directed at as to the solution of the problem. I mean, his wisdom would have been a very helpful, you know, angle to in terms of defining the problem, or in terms of what should be done to restore harmony. And I imagine he had a lot of information in his head, thinking about the stories that are very relevant to most of the cases that we hear. So I think from then on, I began to think differently. It was pretty difficult because I was very accustomed to running the court like a state court or a federal court. I mean, it's always intrigued me to have someone who's well prepared coming in and arguing the fine points of law. But what I enjoyed listening had nothing to do with the victim. you forget about, you begin to think about the procedure so much that you tend to forget the real purpose of a case and what the outcome should be.
Yes. So, Justice Yazzie, in thinking about this, what a powerful story, right? And so here are the rules of the court that would tell you to tell this elderly man that he will be in contempt of court, right? But he's an elder with some wisdom. And I think that there's this way in which sometimes the rules get in the way, in a sense. And I am hearing from you that you felt sort of it didn't sit well with your soul that you had done this. And I think one of the things that is a struggle, I think, in sort of the way we walk through the world with these rules and categories, right? This is the way we should and shouldn't do things. That there's a way in which that necessarily misses the notion of the way in which things are connected when we draw these lines and have to have these boxes and rules. And I wanted to know a little bit more about sort of one of the things you talk about is this notion of how we reconcile ourselves with not just like our family and our community, but with nature and like the entire universe in a sense when we're making things right, to restore good relations, not just with the self, but there's a way in which that relationship to the self is also connected to all things. And I was wondering if I could ask you to share a little bit more about that.
Okay. If I understand your question, I want to go back to your prior question. I can see the potential of our future Navajo courts once we are able to once instead of using the rules of law, which we will in certain cases, but for the most part, we like to make the Navajo restorative justice circle as the dominant, you know, process for the Navajo courts, and I see a real benefit in doing that. So an example would be if there were cases, there are cases pending for child abuse, child neglect, suicide, domestic violence. So in those type of cases, when the people are able to, are given the opportunity to tell their story, and we do have judges now who have taken their black robes off and who no longer sit above the parties. What one judge says, when I enter the court, I change the whole atmosphere. I make sure that I'm not running a formal court, that I'm running an informal court that fits the spirit of the people. When people come in, some are very angry, are very lost, are very afraid. So my job is to greet them just like as though they're my relatives. My job is to tell the people that your province is very important to me. So I sit with them like sitting with the family at a dinner table. And people are very surprised when I take that type of court hearing. And so when I do that, you know, I notice, you know, the change in the people right away. Meaning that if a person comes in very hostile, being uncooperative, and if you tell them in a very nice way that you know, I want to listen to your story. What is going on? Can you tell me? So along the way, when I hear the people talk, then it gives me the opportunity to share those important Navajo creation stories. For example, if I need to talk about the responsibility, accountability, you know, in a situation where I sense, you know, in listening to the people telling their story, they will be telling stories about, you know, that there's bad, poor communication in our family. There's no respect. The reason why we're in court now started from, you know, the husband being jealous against the wife, and there's a lot of misunderstanding. So as the judge hear those stories, the concerns of the people, that gives the judge the opportunity to say, you know, let's go back and see what the story about Guizhou means, the beauty way. And sometimes I heard a judge say that, you know, if you are a very violent person, and that's the kind of lifestyle you live, But now you're saying you want to change things. The best thing for you to do is to really address, you know, your problem. Come to terms with your problem. Then at some point, you can switch, you know, from your negative way of life to a more good way of life. And the judge was saying, this opportunity as a judge to work with the people that way is really, really meaningful. But if I switch to applying the law, the black letter law, I'm working with a box, and I'm working with someone who's charged with battery. Then I have to look at the elements of law. The prosecution would say, you know, our job is done. We've proven the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So they get prosecuted, and people get sent to jail, and nothing is done to discuss the underlying cause that the family has become very dysfunctional.
Yes.
And there's nothing done.
I'm sorry, please finish your thought, and then I want to follow up with that. Well, so what I'm thinking is that there have been times when I've been in court where I've seen judges try to do what it is that you're describing, right? Which is, even though if they're technically like in a Western court, right, that they're following the letter of the law, but they also make some effort to speak to, I hope you turn your life around, you need to look at the underlying issue. And what I notice is, because there's no relationship between that judge and that individual, right, that those words don't really seem to do anything in court most often. Maybe sometimes in a rare circumstance, somebody who's standing in court will have the experience that judge cared and the judge wanted something better for them. But there's no necessarily process by which that person can engage in what the judge is requested, right, or the judge is suggesting. So I'm wondering what it is that you feel makes it such a powerful thing, that conversation that you have with that person, where you're letting them know, you know, where you see judges doing it in a way that's truly effective. What is that that helps that person see what it is that is going on with them?
I think what the people who participate in this restorative justice process, and pretty soon we'd like to see that as a common practice in the court system. And I think what really makes a difference for the parties who come in, people who are victims, people who are defenders, even the judges, even the bailiffs, would see that there is the force of our huizhong, meaning that there's respect, there's a recognition that, you know, that we are human beings, and as human beings, we know definitely, we have a good idea of what it means to be good. We have a definite idea of what it means to be bad. And if consequences are to be dealt with, we know what to do with, because we have legal concepts in our own way by tradition and custom. Like, for example, we have a word called cat, which means, which goes to explaining the kinship unity through the huizhong, the good way value. The good way of recognizing your duties and responsibility, and I think that the doctrine that we really we aspire to is that we are all related one way or another, and we are related to one way or another. And I think what is missing in the adversarial court system is we tend to be very formal. And sometimes people say, Your Honor. Sometimes I feel like saying, don't call me Your Honor. I am Your Honor. Yes, but I have a name. I am your relative. I'm your brother. I'm your father. I'm your grandfather. That kind of relationship makes a big difference. And I think when we talk about these values, we like to give people in our course of this conversation with the victim, the family, the offenders and the family, is to talk about some values that make a lot of sense. For example, what is the meaning of reciprocity and how can that help, you know, to allow the dysfunctional family to become functional again? And I think those core values mean a lot. And I think this is, I mean, if you were allowed to have a session with the family talking about traditional stories, talking about core values, that would change things as to the lives of the people. And I think what is important here, too, is that the change would also say that we need to, you know, do better at our communication. Even as a judge, I need to improve my communication with my fellow people, whether I'm in public or whether I'm with my family. I think good communication with respect is very important. So you have a strong sense of what it means to live a good life, and you also have a strong sense of what it means to live a bad life. And I think if you are able to teach the part that's important about choices, you know, you can choose to do bad, you can choose to do good. But whatever you do, the responsibility is in your hand, the consequences are in your hand. So you make the choice. And I think if we're able to talk to people, and people have come around, people who come in seeking a protection order, at the end of a session such as the one I'm describing here, you know, they don't mind, you know, the restraining order. They would go with it because, you know, they see they have really, really sensed something, and as a result of this type of dynamic in the court process.
Okay, thank you, Justice Yazzie. I'm mindful of the fact that you had asked for a personal break at the start of the call, so we'll give you an opportunity for that, and then we'll move into Q&A. And I'll ask the justice a question in the meanwhile. And we do have some questions already in the queue. So for those on the call, if you'd like to ask a question of Justice Yazzie, please hit *6 and you will get into the queue. And in the meanwhile, Sujatha, I thought while the justice is taking a break, I would ask you. You've been both in the system as a public defender and as a prosecutor, and you've also been, you know, kind of pursuing alternative strategies, you know, in parallel to the system. And I thought I'd kind of ask you the question you asked Justice Yazzie about, you know, forming relationships. How can a judge do that when there's not really a deep relationship? From your experience, how is it possible to bring some of these values into the system, or what I like to call, can we circle the square? If you view kind of these alternative practices as kind of the notion of a circle and interdependence, and our traditional systems as more linear, hierarchical, kind of square-like, is there a way effectively to bring some of these thoughts and principles into the square, or do you feel that there needs to be kind of a parallel system almost in order to really effectuate this?
Well, that's a tough question. I think it's the perennial question that I struggle with. I look to Justice Yazzie to see what it means to circle the square. And I wonder, I don't have a particularly positive answer to this question, unfortunately. When I think about it from the perspective of the Western court system, I wonder, I have more belief and hope, obviously, that this could happen at the Navajo Nation, where this notion that you would walk into court and see a judge as your father, your brother, your aunt, your grandmother, your grandfather, right? Like that this is an understanding that I think we've had a breakdown in Western community. And I feel this as an immigrant in a sense, right? That there were stronger feelings of family and community during those 3-4 months a year I would spend in India as a child, as I do here, where my biological family is scattered across the nation and we rarely see one another. And so without that embedded notion of, or that lived experience of your neighbors are your family, they are, you know, these words that we hear, all my relations, from the wisdom of American Indian people, First Nations people, I think it's harder for us to have that in our bones in Western society in a lot of ways. And particularly as an immigrant, I feel this. And so when I interact with the Western court systems, I have trouble figuring out how to do that. I can figure out how to do that in an individual relationship with a client. When I was a public defender, I saw those men in prison, in jail, as my brothers, as my closest person. I tried to do that in my individual practice. But then when it came to how I wrote the brief or made the argument in court, it was harder to do that. It's harder to feel that same sense of interconnectedness with the judge, with my opponent, especially when I was doing death penalty work. To imagine opposing counsel as my beloved brother, who is seeking the execution of my client, right? That is a challenge, and maybe more about my own personal journey and what I need to do personally to open that up. But so, in the meanwhile, I think I'm trying to create. Yeah, go ahead, Preeta. Sorry.
No, sorry. I was just, as you were speaking, something was coming up for me, which is, this notion that your judge is your father or your uncle or your grandfather or your grandmother, that's beautiful. But from, I think, the Western perspective, that's obviously a double-edged sword. You've worked a lot with children of, let's say, sexual abuse. What would happen in those situations where the principles of authority, the people in authority, are the ones that, if they've not been actively involved in some of these abuses, they have certainly been aware of, condoned them, looked the other way. I'm thinking of certain communities where, they have their own systems of justice, and there are instances where abuse within communities is not fully addressed because of that. And I just wonder if you have thoughts on that.
Sure. I think a part of it is coming to a better understanding of what it is that we say when we say, I am your mother, I am your sister, right? Certainly there are abusive mothers and sisters and fathers and uncles out there. I think a big part of the work is calling us back to the meaning of these words, right? So if we're going to be operating in a process as a relative, what does it mean to be a relative? What does it mean to be in relation in that way with others? So I think we need to come back to the meaning of those words, not just think of them as statuses in the sense that we automatically get because of biology or circumstance, right? So that's, I think, an important piece of the work, is to re-embed the values of those positions into the meaning of those things. It's not simply because I birthed a child that I get to be a mother, right? I have to behave as what a mother is.
I guess what I'm saying is, but if the harm occurred because someone didn't have that sense of the relationship,
So then a part of the work is helping a person return to an understanding of what that is, right? So if the harm occurred because of an unhealthy use of a power differential, a part of the work is working with the person who did that harm in relationship to that power differential to return to their understanding of what it truly is to be a mother, right? But there have to be safety mechanisms put into place in order to allow that conversation to happen, right? So it's not like an individualistic view. It's got to be a collective view. So, for example, in the restorative justice processes that I facilitate, I don't believe that we can just have like a dialogue between the two people, because the pre-existing problem is still there between them. We need to call in all those who help those two people be their best selves and people who have been witness to this dynamic, people who have been a part of it, so that they can help call these people back to their best selves. Who is it in their lives that helps them be their best selves and wants to see this thing move forward in a positive way? That needs to be attended to in the restorative justice process.
Right. Okay. Justice Yazzie, do we have you back?
Yes, I'm back.
Wonderful.
I'm here.
So we have a few callers in the queue, but I thought I would take and I would just remind other callers, if you'd like to get in the queue, press *6 to ask a question live. We have a few that have come in through the web form. But before I ask you those, I thought I would take a little bit of the moderator's prerogative to ask, you know, you mentioned earlier that you had always thought that being a lawyer was kind of, you know, an ultimate form of doing good, of bringing a powerful good into the world. And I guess I'm curious as to, you know, what inspired you to attend law school, Western Law School, and then what inspired you to come back to, what in your personal journey inspired you to come back to Navajo notions of justice? And I guess related to that is, did you grow up with strong sense of Navajo notions of justice, or did you have to rediscover that later in life?
I think it's a long story. I can sit all day and tell you all about the challenges that I went through. But I was born on the Navajo land, Navajo reservation, and I was my mother was the sole parent, and there were about 4 siblings, and she couldn't afford to keep all of us, and also she lived with her other sister and her children. So all our life we spent herding sheep. Sometimes we had to do one take care of 100 300 heads of sheep or even more. And that was a job, an all-day job. So my mother spent her life doing rug weaving, and we lived way out in the middle of nowhere. No electricity, no running water. And which I thought, I mean, my experience of that as a childhood was I had some of my best moments back then. But people say, you know, but you didn't have running water, you had no electricity, you had no transportation. You must have been, you know, I feel very sorry for you. I mean, I said, there's no need to be sorry. Because, I mean, I had everything in life at my disposal to enjoy. But anyway, what inspired me is that the hardship I went through, like sometimes not having any food to eat, but you know, then somehow you just some spirit is speaking to you, but life goes on. And so I went to boarding school. At boarding school, where we were told, do not speak your language, do not practice your culture, do not see medicine people. You have to go to church. You have to forget about your life, your traditional lifestyle. So I did that. So I graduated from a Christian high school at Cohoes in New Mexico, and thereafter I had this thought of being a minister, you know, become. I mean, literally, I thought, you know, I'm going to the point of become a part of an all white community with a white family. But I mean, my path started. When I graduated from high school, I went to Calvin College. It's a Christian college in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And my thought there was, I'm going to do the 4 years and then go into seminary. But I could only take one semester of Calvin College. And since there, I think it was I woke up to some of the things that. That I had to consider in my life. Who am I? Where do I come from? So I think I left. I left after one semester. Then thereafter, just right then and there, the Indians in the Bay Area took over Alcatraz. And I went over there and became a part of the Alcatraz takeover for a short time. And later on, the wounded knee, I wanted to go to see what was going on there. At that time, I was going to Oberlin College, and there were no other Indians on campus. I was the only one attending college with a number of Jewish students, most of which were living up from the East Coast. But anyway, so I think just being by myself, spending a lot of time traveling myself, and sometimes I had to hitchhike from one end of the country to the other end. So I think in that process, I began to become more conscious of how my people were, our state of being. And I needed to know more about who I am in relation to my relatives, in relation to my culture, in relation to the songs and prayers and ceremonies. And I've did that for a time, and I think I'm at a point where I feel very satisfied that I have gone through all these experiences and challenges within my own circle of restorative justice. So I think I'm at a point where I'm about to write a textbook on the fundamental law of the Diné to explain more to my people and to the world about what does the natural law mean, what does the custom and traditional law mean, and what does the common law mean, and how does that, what is it, and how does it apply to our life today. So in the book, I hope to put in all the issues and the perspectives that we discussed today. So what was my inspiration? I think the hardship, you know, the sense of resilience that I had since I was a child, the sense that I can do things. And there were a lot of times when people says, there is no such thing as I can't. My uncle, when he went to the World War II, and he used to always sit at the dinner table, and my brother, my oldest brother, and I would listen to him. One of the things he said was, "When you walk in life, if you fall on your face, get up again and go at it until you finish whatever you started." And I think that's so true to our Navajo way of thinking. And so one of the things where Navajo mind does best is when there is a trauma at hand. What is it that you do? What is it that we can do? I think this is where people say having more than one mind in terms of thinking out the problem, thinking out the solution is really has a lot, tremendous power, tremendous, there's tremendous potential. And I think as I talk about, you know, putting the example of putting the net Jewish system back in, into the net way into the Jewish system, I think that's a sign that you know we are on our way to change things here in the Navajo Nation. It's a big job. I mean, not everybody talks and thinks like the way I'm talking today. I think some of our people have graduated, but they're very content with the life they live. They want to do 8 to 5, and they want to drive their car. They want to live in a beautiful home. But I like to be out traveling, meeting people, learning things, learning some differences. And sometimes I think the people in America, mainly the non-Indians, have to do much better with the quality of education. And at one time I met a Dutch man up in Amsterdam, because I saved up money to travel in Europe on my own. So he asked me what caused me to become a lawyer. I think that shared the desire. And when the mind says I want to, you know, do this, there's no way to say no to your own mind. And I think that I have that drive and I have that kind of spirit, and I want to, you know, use that energy to teach our Navajo young people, our young minds.
What a remarkable story. Yeah. What a beautiful story. You know, it's interesting. You say your mind had the drive to become a lawyer, and then at some point your spirit kind of led you to recover and go back and rediscover your spiritual heritage. I just out of curiosity, how did your people, the Navajo Nation, welcome you back after you had such a completely Western orientation and, you know, Christian orientation? How was that transition back, and how did they accept the notions you had of bringing some indigenous teachings back into the judicial system of the Navajo Nation?
I think that acceptance is always there. It's just a natural part of the life, the way we live. We are very, very generous people. And so the relatives who welcomed me back were able to see, they were able to tell the type of person I was, or came to be. And what they did is that you have a lot of good, you have learned a lot of good tools, but there's one thing that we need to do, is to have you relearn the Navajo way of education at the Hogan level. We need for you to, we need to have a ceremony over you.
Wow. That's fabulous. So I'm going to turn to some of the questions we've had.
Yes. Oh. Because, you know, I've developed a lot of negativity, building up resentment in my whole well-being. That, you know, that it was true that I didn't understand sometimes myself when I get angry. But I think the more I went to ceremonies, I mean, I would sit in the ceremony all night and be able to learn something, you know, one thing at a time. So I think now I'm at a point where I'm not perfect, you know. I don't know all there is to know, but I think I've learned enough to say I'm very proud of myself in a good way, and it's something that I want to share with my young relatives, including my grandchildren, including my own children.
That's great. So I'm going to turn to one of the questions that's been submitted via our live webcast. This is a question from Rhode Island, and it's a series of questions around the power of circle when there's difficult domestic issues. So the question is, the children of sexual abuse by family members could be harmed by giving those family members so much power over them in the circle. How do you resolve this? And then the same person also asks that disorganized personalities like sociopaths often use self-serving stories to spin a web of lies and may bribe or manipulate others into supporting them. How would the Navajo circle protect against that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I that question was asked of me last week at a continuing legal education session down in Phoenix. And one of Navajo woman attorney asked me the question. He said the question was, does the Navajo peacemaking circle have the capability to address, you know, very serious crime? So, and another white woman lawyer asked the question. I think she said that this circle, the circular notion of justice, I think to talk about, you know, resolving serious crimes in the circle, I think a serious misconception. So that didn't bother me. But my response to the Navajo woman attorney was that, you know, what did our relatives do 100 years ago, 200 years ago? How did they resolve these serious crimes then? Before the white people came to this country, before that our system of justice, the imposition of that system on us took place, what did we do? And that's all I needed to say. That was my response. And I think what I need to say is that, I mean, there's too much of imposition. I mean, so one of the things that I'm doing with the students here, I teach law classes here at the Navajo Technical University. We're soon to turn our program to a four-year law degree. But anyway, I tell my students, says, this is the way the American system of justice works. These are the rules of law. This is the system. This is the process. And then we look, on the other hand, we have our own system of justice. And our own system of justice takes on the model of the outside world. I said, it is time that we look at our own system. Sometimes people say, well, we have nothing. Well, let's start with nothing. Let's put something in there. And I think in that way, you know, people are beginning to realize that. I want people to realize that Navajo has, we have a framework. We always have a framework to deal with those any types of issues. And that respect, if our young people learn the law, they should be grounded in the American legal system, as well as to really know the roots of our own legal system, and not to assume that that the American legal system means a means to solve our problems. So I think your question about, you know, what about these child abuse? How do you deal with them? You know, I mean, I don't have an answer for you. But what I can say that's definitely the case is if you allow the people to deal with those issues in a circle, once they have, you know, spent time learning about the problem, what's causing the problem, what are the underlying issues to that sexual abuse, then the people can come together and have their say. The relatives can come in. They have the solution. If you leave them to come up with those solutions, that means they are able to heal themselves. They know what to do. I mean, I'm here. I'm, as a judge, I might be here just to facilitate the process. And I mean, I think that's probably one of the best means in dealing with that type of issues.
Right. We have another question from a caller in New York City. She says that I am full of questions. Where geographically is the Navajo Nation? Is the Navajo judicial system independent of the Western judicial system? And does the Western judicial system honor and recognize the Navajo justice system?
Yes. In America, I tell my students we're very different from the whole world, other countries. In this country, we have the American government, we have the state government, we have the tribal government. And there is a relationship between all those three. And what we have with the government and the Indian people is we have a political relationship, meaning that the government has recognized our status as a nation, our sovereign, we are a sovereign, and we have been recognized as such as back as 1832, pursuant to the earlier U.S. Supreme Court cases, and where Chief Justice John Marshall back then in 1832 has said that the American Indians are to be recognized as a quasi-community. They have the right to make their own law and to be governed by them. So we still have this the pleasure to access resort to our internal our inherent power. And I think that the roots are still there. And when we talk about the circle, you know, that's part of our inherent power. And so, meanwhile, whenever we have to deal with the state government, the federal government, I think especially with the state government, the only type of relationship we have is when we go to court, and the issue is always do the Navajo Nation have jurisdiction over this case involving non-Indians, and I think what the Supreme Court has decided that, you know, Navajo Nation and as well as other Indian nations do not have criminal jurisdiction to try non-Indians for the crime they commit in Indian country.
Right.
And see, it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, every sovereign, every jurisdiction should have that the authority to punish people who do wrong in their jurisdiction. I'll give you an example. If a non-Indian committed sexual abuse here, we do not have the power to prosecute that person. And the state may have jurisdiction over that. The federal government, if Congress allows for it, they may have the jurisdiction to prosecute that person. And there's one thing that I should mention, that every year up in Minnesota, and I just heard this in a discussion, in a discussion session, that every year a number of Indian women get raped during hunting season, and the tribe up there have no jurisdiction whatsoever. The state has no jurisdiction. The feds have no means to prosecute those incidences. And so, at best, now the Congress has said, yes, we'll give criminal jurisdiction to the Indian nations to handle crimes related to domestic violence involving non-Indians. So to do that, I mean, to say yes to that type of arrangement is to allow the federal government to move in, and the federal government would like to have the applicability of the U.S. constitutional criminal procedural safeguards used in these matters. And I think that imposition shouldn't be. If there was to be a true recognition of our own sovereign, we should be the one to handle those cases based upon our own inherent powers.
Okay, wonderful. So we're coming up on the close of the call. Sujata, I'll pass it on to you if you have a few closing comments or remarks.
Sure. So just briefly, in going back to the question around sexual harm, one of the things that has been most moving to me and what I have learned from the indigenous people of this continent can be seen in a film that's put out by the Canadian Film Review Board called Hollow Water. And it speaks powerfully about the ways in which Indigenous peacemaking methodologies, and the circle in particular, was used to root out transgenerational sexual trauma that was caused by the boarding school crisis there in Canada, something that's been unearthed by the truth and reconciliation processes there. And so this very powerful film for those who are interested in learning more about how circle has been powerfully used to to address things in Canada in ways that our jurisdiction here in the United States does not allow, but Canada has had the wisdom to allow their First Nations people to do this. So a film called Hollow Water, I would see it to learn a little bit more about what I think it is that we should be allowing our tribes to do here. Just in closing, Justice Yazzie, I want to thank you so much. Every time I hear you speak, I feel that you have brought me closer to Hojon, to the good, and to looking for that in myself, in these values and principles that I know are so difficult to translate into English, but somehow you managed to do so for us. And so I just want to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart for your continued sharing of your wisdom, for having come out into the Western world, and so that you have this amazing capacity to see sort of both sides of how the world operates and to find some way to help us find our place to the middle. So thank you all very much, and thanks for the wonderful questions from the callers. And thanks to Service Space and to Awaken for making these calls possible.
And thank you, Justice Yazzie, as well. I'd like to especially thank you for your heartfelt sharing about your personal journey and your story, which was really quite remarkable. We always like to end these calls with one final question, which is, how can we, as a larger Server Space community, support your work?
I think that what I really like about what I'm doing these days is the opportunity to share what I've experienced, and to share the concerns that I have. And I was asked a question by the Awakening organization, and what is on your bucket list? And so the response I gave is to publish a treatise on Navajo common law. And I think this I'm taking on this project. It's a very unique project, one of its kind, I like to say, because it's everything is aimed at explaining the Navajo the indigenous legal thinking. And I think the more I share my knowledge on the topic, the more I there's some good questions that I get from the larger audience, including the non Indians as well as the Indian people, and I think I aim to publish this treatise and use it to benefit our community, to benefit the whole Navajo Nation, as well as other Indian nations, as well as America. And I think the more we share, the more we give meaning to the type of life we live here in America. So the end result is that I mentioned earlier the phrase "sihasin," which means resilience, and I think. I always tell people that the Navajo legal concept of Sehasin means, despite all the negative comments or negative impacts, achieving a result that's most positive, and in our case, consistent with our elements of Navajo thinking, is the main thing that we have. And I can say that, of course, we always miss something, that when we talk about this resilience, the way we understand it, there are pluses and minuses, meaning that we may not achieve resilience 100% all the time, but nothing is perfect, our elders would say. But at least, you know, making the effort to think about, to plan for it, to make a living possible, and to go after the restorative justice efforts, we can see that there is an end result that means something that is, in our case, based on our own traditional notice of restorative justice. Thank you. I enjoyed talking with all of you.
Yes, thank you. So we will. We will hold a collective moment of silence in gratitude for our remarkable guest. Wonderful. Thank you to Justice Yazzie. Thank you to our remarkable Sujata Balika, and thanks to all of our listeners and callers. We look forward to speaking with you on another Way of Waking call.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.